What's the first thing you remember after the accident?
I was in panic mode.
That's because you couldn't breathe.
Yeah, I remember I could breathe in, like normally, like. But when I tried to breathe out, it was like breathing out of a straw. So immediately I was like trying to explain to the cops, something's wrong, something's wrong, something's wrong. And I knew I had a matter of seconds before I blacked out because the oxygen to the brain was just depleting. The next conscious memory is 3 weeks later in Johns Hopkins ICU, surrounded by doctors, with a ventilator down my throat, machines, tubes everywhere. And my parents are there and they're crying. So I start crying. Well, at least look like I'm crying because my tear ducts can't work because my body's paralyzed.
You're listening to the Helping Up podcast, all about addiction, recovery, and grace. I'm Vic King, a chaplain at Helping Up Mission in Baltimore, Maryland, and this month, a resurrection story of sorts. Pastor Gary interviews Greg Pabst. Greg grew up in Towson, just up the road, and he spent most of his late teens and early 20s ping-ponging around from one rehab to another. Greg's recovery story is marked by a sense of gratitude, by a reconnection with his family, and a renewed sense of purpose. We hope it's an encouragement to you.
All right, so Greg, born in Baltimore?
Baltimore County,
Baltimore
Towson,
County,
Ruston.
Towson. Grew up in a family, how many kids?
I had two older brothers, Ben and Alex. All of us are 2 years apart.
Okay, so you're the baby of the family.
I am the baby.
And how old are you?
I am 25, turned 26 in March.
Okay. What I know about your family now is they're very active in church life and ministry, you know, as lay people. Was it always that way in your growing up? Did you grow up into a family that was very active in church and ministry?
Yes. My earliest memories, my childhood of church was the Brethren. We went to the Brethren Church, and it was very different than mm-hmm. anything I've ever been to. But ever since 1995, I've been at Grace Fellowship Church.
So that's over 20 years.
Yep.
And where'd you go to high school?
Friends school. Graduated 09.
Friends school. Good education.
Yep. My grandfather went there. My mom went there. And both my brothers went there.
Okay. So. Interesting. All right. Were you always the guy that was out there on the fringe, on the edge, always pushing the edges, ends of the envelope? Was that you?
That was me. Yeah. Ever since, I would say, fourth grade when I started at Friends, I was the one who brought curse words around friends, and they're like, "Oh wow, where'd you learn these words?" And
so there was a rebel streak in you
that was
definite, starting early. And when did chemicals enter into the story for you?
Chemicals entered in the story the end of eighth grade, going into ninth grade. That was the first time I got drunk. I'd had alcohol before, you know, taste of beer or whatever, wine. But that was the first time I can remember that I got drunk. And it was off 30 of Natty Light, Natural Light. And I was with some friends. And we snuck out of my one friend's house and met up with some girls. And that started something.
Did the drinking, was it about fitting into a peer group? Or was it, and you've heard guys say, man, when I started drinking, I just felt normal. I felt like I was a regular, normal person. And then up until that point, I didn't feel normal. And I drank and I felt normal.
I felt that I always fit in wherever, whichever group. I felt like a chameleon for that part. But for me, the alcohol and chemicals in general, it was like I wasn't given the instructions in life. And then when I started drinking and putting chemicals in, it was like I'd learned the instructions and I was like everyone else. It was like I went out to play football and I'm wearing lacrosse gear.
That's how you felt.
That's how I felt,
yes.
Always. You know, I was like, I didn't get the memo.
Yeah.
I didn't, you know, something was missing,
yeah.
basically.
Yeah.
And when I touched chemicals, I immediately recognized that after a while, I was like, wow, that wasn't, like, that's gone. Like, that's, I'm, like, normal in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
Or I am not anxious. I'm not depressed. I'm there. There were no consequences to my life, you know. My actions basically felt that I could get away with anything and I could push the limits, and I had a big problem with authority figures in that sense, because they tried to show me that there are consequences and they would push back.
Yeah. So when did we graduate to other chemicals?
Graduated soon after, after that summer, beginning of freshman year, started smoking pot. And from there on out, pot began just normal thing of life. Like, all my friends did it, either every weekend and slowly to every day. And that got into distribution to supply my habit, basically. But
still in high school years.
Ninth grade year.
Yeah.
And then that's when oxys still were available and not regulated. So yeah, that was my first experience with opiates and would later become my drug of choice.
By ninth grade, you gotten into this other stuff. Were you selling the other stuff too?
No, not yet. I had noticed it was more expensive, and I saw what it did to some people, and I saw what it did to my aunt. My aunt was a pretty big dry eye. She's in recovery now. And
so you saw that bothered you.
Yeah.
You didn't want to be that person.
No, and she was bad. I remember as a child, her getting a brand new, like, $70,000 Lexus, and like the next week DEA had confiscated it, and there was nothing she could do about it. And I remember that memory early. My mom was like, outlined her as like bad in my life and tried to separate us and tried to instill in me that addiction is in my family and I am prone to it. So I still had that thought while I was seeing these hard drugs starting to come up. And I still had that thought, like, you know, I know this is not the right thing to do. So I don't want to push it. I don't want to put a needle in my arm yet.
Yeah. And all this time you're going to church.
Still going to church,
a good church,
but rebelling against church, not wanting to wake up on Sundays, especially because I'm beginning to get hangovers and I'm still starting to get the effects of the drug abuse.
Did your parents suspect?
Yeah, they suspected, especially sophomore year. I was arrested for the first time and put in baby booking for fictitious license. I had a friend who was making fake IDs. And I was selling fake IDs to my friends, and I got caught with a bunch of them. And I was starting baby booking down in the city, which was a wake-up call for me. Began getting drug tested by my parents.
But did you beat the test?
I did. Yeah. Eventually, I mean, at first I was pretty scared. You know, they made threats of, like, sending me away, stuff like that. So at first I was clean, and then I began to learn about how to get away with drug tests and keep urines warm and blah, blah, blah.
This was your world all the way through the end of high school? Did anything else?
Yeah. Yeah, things start from then on, things went pretty downhill. By junior year, I'd gotten into cocaine, and I noticed that allowed me to drink longer, for longer periods of time. I immediately recognized that in my brain. And one night, my friend and I, we stole one of our friend's cars, and we're on our way to go get cocaine. But before we had done that, we drank a whole bottle of promethazine with codeine for my friend's dad, who had Thorazine for thyroid cancer. It's terrible. I know, very bad. But we didn't feel anything at first, because that's a slow-acting opiate at first. And then it hit us while we were driving. I remember driving, and then I woke up in the passenger side, and we had crashed, and the police were there. And apparently I had started trying to fight the police, so they threw me again into baby booking. And from there on, the school found out. They agreed to allow me to finish my junior year at an inpatient rehab in Pennsylvania. So I started that in May of my junior year. And that was good for the first 30 days. You know, I felt good. They said, you'll be home for summer. You're not going to do the next 3 months of extended. But then on that last day, my counselor said, you've been recommended to do 3 more months here. And once again, I lost it and tried to run away. And they got me. And then I agreed to it. So I started my next 3 months there. But was not fully committed. Mm-hmm. And one day I broke into the men's unit, stole tobacco because we weren't allowed to smoke. Got arrested in rehab. And, the kid who I broke into the unit with, he got kicked out. He died 8 days later. That really hit me. Yeah. At that point, I wasn't doing anything. I wasn't waking up. I wasn't going to meetings or classes. I just said no to everything. So one night I got woken up at like 3 a.m. by these two big, like, ex-military guys, and they had, like, a court form. They're like, you have to come with us. Your parents have signed this consent form, and you're under 18. So I was on a plane to Utah, and I had to do a 30-day wilderness therapy.
Yeah.
Which they had a sister program with a program in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. If you get arrested in rehab, I mean, you've already been taken out of society because you have a drug problem. You get sent to rehab. You get arrested in rehab, in trouble in rehab, you can get sent here in the middle of nowhere, Utah. If you act out here, then you're going to start to get in the penal system. You're going to mm-hmm. be just a number. And mm-hmm. from there, it's a harder road from there.
Yeah.
So it woke me up to consequences mm-hmm. that, you know, I was just in Baltimore, Maryland, and it's PA, now to Utah, and this is where my actions are leading. So there are consequences, and I'm starting to wake up, and I'm starting to look at the big picture and perspective. So I learned a lot out there, more so than I did in rehab.
So this is before your senior year.
Yep.
You go back to friends.
Go back to friends.
And yep. did okay during that senior year?
Yep. I was on honor roll for the first time. I was sober for about 7 months. I had a new girlfriend. Things were good. You know, I was doing the right thing. I wasn't really working a program, like a 12-step program.
And was church any different for you?
Church was a part of my life. I was okay. back going every Sunday, volunteering.
All right. So it all felt pretty good and worked pretty well.
Yeah.
You graduated from Friends.
Graduated 2009. I was accepted at High Point University in North Carolina. But before that happened, the night of July 4th, I drove across Cold Spring Lane into the other side of Cold Spring Lane over by Homeland and got my first DUI. And at this point, I'm 18, so this is a real charge.
Yeah. Had you started drinking after you graduated? Were you celebrating?
Yep. And I was like, I want to be ready for college. You know, I can drink in college.
Yeah.
I'm good. Yeah. You know, I'm not going to do pot or yeah. opiates.
So you had the accident and got a DUI. So you started, you know, the thing you said you didn't want to.
Now I had a record.
Yep.
For a moment, yeah.
So did you go to High Point?
I did. So I started High Point. I was studying business administration. I was doing well. Started get back into like pot and cocaine. I joined a fraternity. I did well for my freshman year. I got through it. But the fraternity life definitely took a big toll. I mean, I don't want to use that as an excuse, but.
No, but that's the deal. You put yourself there.
Yeah.
You wanted to do it.
I wanted to do it. And yeah. it was like a brotherhood. And I don't know, looking back, a lot of it was very superficial and very.
Sure.
Anyway, my sophomore year, I went back for my sophomore year in North Carolina. And I moved into a fraternity apartment. And one night, I have to rewind. My summer year, I worked at the Science Center and did Segway rides, Segway tours. Mm. So Segways are in my mind. Remember that. So the security at High Point rode around on Segways.
Ah.
My sophomore year, there was a noise complaint. We were throwing bottles and being very loud. This nice, like, old, poor woman on the Segway rolled over. She's on security. I guess she just said, like, can you guys quiet down or whatever? And I apparently got into it with her about having her give me the Segway because I am, like, a licensed Segway driver in my mind. Very intoxicated. So yeah. apparently I wrestled her to the ground, stole the Segway. And campus police came, real police came. I went before the judiciary committee. They were like, you can go risk expulsion on your record, or you can withdraw for medical reasons. The fraternity I was in, the son of the president of the school was actually in my fraternity, so I think they didn't want the fraternity to get any bad press with this incident. They kind of want to sweep it under the rug, medical reasons, kid withdraws from High Point. So I left, went back to Baltimore.
And that was a gift from God for you, really.
Honestly, yeah, because that I probably would not have been able to be in school today.
Yeah. So you went back home. And now we're how old?
At that point, I'm 19. Part of my plan was I started an intensive outpatient, was forced to take antabuse,
yes,
not drink. I violated that, so I was kicked out of outpatient program. I started taking non-degree earning classes at Towson, so to keep the school momentum going a little bit, because I do enjoy school. But I met up with some old friends, and they were pretty heavy into the opiate, doing it, selling it. It was pretty prevalent everywhere. And I got addicted to painkillers, opiates, and I began to experience physical withdrawals for the first time. I'd never really experienced that from alcohol, weed, coke, X, anything. They were expensive. So soon that led to what my drug of choice is today, heroin. Yeah. I tried sobering up, and I tried the geographic relocation. I moved to Florida with some friends. I lived in St. Petersburg for 2 years, went to University of South Florida, moved north to Winter Park, Orlando for 2 years, and I actually did pretty well there. I had a friend who was pretty in the music scene, and we did a live stream company where we'd live stream DJs that we liked and put it on the internet. But at my fourth year down there in Florida, I got my second DUI. And that was bad. I tried fleeing the scene accident. It was outside one of the clubs that we were throwing a show at. I was on probation for a year. All I wanted to do was get back home to Baltimore, because most of my friends had left. Some went out to LA to pursue some careers in the music scene. I was left alone and became pretty alcoholic because I couldn't use drugs. I was getting drug tested on probation, but I could get away with alcohol. And that was probably the only time I was truly alcoholic, where I'd wake up and need a drink and
okay.
get shakes and stuff.
Yeah. And at that point, when you got back into Maryland, was it alcohol primarily, or was
Oh, no. At that point, I was off probation. On the drive up, I stopped by Druid Park, West Baltimore. I crossing into Baltimore. I was back on dope, heroin.
So then 2015, how did we get to meet?
I was homeless, so my drug addiction had fueled to me robbing my parents and them finding out, them kicking me out of the house. And I was homeless for about like 2 days. I couldn't do it. I'm not one of those people that can do it.
Yeah.
I'm really not. Still using. I actually slept on a bench on Caroline Street right near the Hum, and I had no idea that this was the mission. My image of the mission was very different than what
sure
this place actually
yeah, mine
is.
Was too. Well, of right. course, when I got here, it was that.
But well, yeah, yeah, for, yeah.
But that's it's yeah, it's a lot different now for sure.
I pictured that white cross, like mission. I remember like driving through the city, like seeing that somewhere. Mission. That's all I thought of, like this shelter. Yeah. Dangerous, you get robbed, you know. Just
but you wound up here, so what happened? How'd you go from 2 nights on the streets, can't take this?
I called my dad, and he had a friend whose son was doing very well here. They were like, you want to try this? And I was like, I'll try anything at this point. So I was dropped off here.
Who dropped you off?
My parents, like, driver. He, like, drove me to school when I... growing up, and
yep.
he was my grandfather's driver in the first place, became best friends, and he's basically family.
Yep, yep.
But works for my parents.
But he's the one that picked you up, found you, picked you up,
yep.
and brought you here.
And brought me here.
Did they clean you up before you got here?
No.
No, just brought you here.
Yeah, I was dirty, I was strung out.
So you walked, it's still, yeah, still high, so you walked in the front door, and it wasn't what you expected.
No, it wasn't. Another thing was one of the staff members here, I had recently met at my church, and I just found out that he works at the mission. I didn't know him that well, but seeing him there helped me as well.
Yeah, yeah. So you immediately decided I can stay here for a while. I can do this.
Well, at first I was told I couldn't be on Suboxone, and I was maintaining my withdrawals and my heroin addiction with Suboxone.
Mm-hmm.
Prescribed it mm-hmm. quite a bit, and I called my dad. I was like, "Dad, they won't let you in on Suboxone." I was like, "Is there any way I can stay at your house for like a week and try to titrate, withdraw mm-hmm. myself off of it?" And my dad, I remember this. My dad was like, "Greg, this is that moment, you know, where you make the decision if you really want this." And he's like, "You can't come home. You can't.
This I love you.
I love you. And this is why, you know."
Yeah.
I kind of, that was a surrender moment for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I really relied a lot on Suboxone. It's
yeah,
very powerful drug. And yeah, I don't want to get into that, but right. I surrendered. I agreed. I was like, I can do this.
So how long did it take you to get through all that?
The withdrawals yeah. and the sick? I didn't sleep for probably like 2 weeks.
Yeah.
I'd maybe get an hour of sleep a night. It was bad. I tried going to detox, Kevin sent me to, and then some suicide took my bed. And I was back and forth with trying to get into a detox, and I just gave up. I was like, "Kevin, I'm just, you know, I want to remember this pain."
Yeah.
And I was at that point.
That was good, yeah.
But it was hard.
So a couple weeks, then you finally settled in.
Things started to clear up for me in my mind.
All right. You were here that time how long?
10 months.
Okay, you know, I remember you as not terribly focused, not terribly serious, but not a bad guy. That's how I would remember how I remembered you. And you got the privilege of going to school, going to college early.
Very early.
You did how many semesters? Was it one plus?
I did one fall semester, and then I was in the middle of my spring semester.
Yeah,
I did well fall, made dean's list.
You remember, maybe you don't remember, but I remember having you and Matt come up front and talk and share. And I told you how surprised and proud of you I was, because
the accident, too.
Yeah, I didn't see it coming. And so I was really proud of you. You'd done a lot of good work, and you really had.
I had, yeah.
You really did. And I think it was pretty sincere and focused work, and I think everybody felt that way. But then
people ask me all the time, you know, why. That week that I had my accident was my birthday, was that week as well. And I think part of me thinks that it was because I was doing so well. Maybe I could get away with one. Which would be a reservation in that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'd earned it, and it's just one, and I can regroup now, and I'm going to be okay, and all those thoughts, I guess. You didn't dream that you'd get back into using again. Of course, you didn't.
I didn't, yeah.
But you didn't dream that. That's not what you were thinking. I just wanted to get away with one.
Yeah, and I thought I could, and I was No, I didn't see it coming.
And you didn't
either. My parents didn't.
So you got the family car to go to it, told them you were going to a meeting.
Yep.
Didn't even plan. At that point, you were not going to the meeting. You knew you weren't. You went right to the drug man, got your stuff.
Yep.
And you knew where you wanted to go to get the stuff.
Oh, yeah. It's the same place. Well, first I did some coke to get up, you know. I used to always like to get the stimulant in and then numb myself with the dope after.
Yeah, gotcha.
So when I did the dope, I did like a third of a gel cap, which is not a lot. Even if you don't have a tolerance, that's not a lot. And I know I was clean for the last 10 months, so I had no tolerance. I don't even remember feeling high, that good feeling, that warm feeling. It was like immediately just out. Immediate overdose.
And the last thing you remember was?
Loud crash. I shot up while driving my mom's car.
While driving.
Which something was normal for me, because that's something I would do very easily in the past.
So you were doing what you knew to do.
Yeah, I'd never OD before. I had crashed into a bus off Maryland Avenue. After I had crashed into the bus, I guess at some point I had gotten sick. And because of where my head was placed and because I wasn't really conscious, I aspirated on the vomit and it went into my lungs. And that's really the thing that almost killed me.
Yeah.
That was it.
Yeah. What's the first thing you remember after the accident?
I got hit with Narcan. That's what I was told. But I remember waking up and being immediately like withdrawn, immediately sick, cold. But something else was there. I was in panic mode.
That's because you couldn't breathe.
Yeah. I remember I could breathe in like normally, like, but when I tried to breathe out, it was like breathing out of a straw. So immediately I was like trying to explain to the cops, something's wrong, something's wrong, something's wrong. And I knew I had a matter of seconds before I blacked out because the oxygen to the brain was just depleting. And the next conscious memory is 3 weeks later in Johns Hopkins ICU, surrounded by doctors, with a ventilator down my throat, machines, tubes everywhere. And my parents are there and they're crying. So I start crying. Well, at least look like I'm crying because my tear ducts can't work because my body's paralyzed. They had paralytic agents flowing through my bloodstream. I had to accept that I was in a coma for the last 3 weeks. And numerous times I nearly lost my life. My organs were shut down. They had to pronate my body several times where they flip my body over, you know, and hand pump air into my lungs because they're failing. And, you know, my cousin called my mom asking if she should go overseas or if she had to be there to bury me. And my mom's just praying over my body that she doesn't have to bury her youngest kid. And that was it, yeah.
It was just an everyday prayer here. And we really, I couldn't see how you'd come out of it. And if you did, I just couldn't imagine that you wouldn't have brain damage. I just couldn't see that you coming back.
So because I stayed on the ventilator so long, the muscles in my throat were weak to the point where I couldn't swallow or drink any liquids for a matter of 30 days. And I can't explain to you the cravings I had for water.
Yeah. You described that one time. I had cravings for drugs, but it was nothing like my craving for water.
And I tried to like explain it to like the C's or like a drug addict who knows what a drug craving's like, but it's when it's something you take for granted, like a simple drink of water or a breath of fresh air, and you can't have that. That's restricted from you. It's, it's definition of powerless.
Yeah, yeah.
For real. I went home for a month to recover because I still had feeding tube, gallbladder drain. I was still very sick. I had lost 40 pounds.
So when was the day that you showed up at Friday Chapel?
2 weeks into April, maybe 10 days. But I was still tubes, everything, but I still came.
Was that, you were there for Matt's graduation?
I was there for Matt's graduation, which was beginning of May.
Okay. Yours would have been
May 20th,
and his was a couple weeks before yours.
Yeah.
So you showed up that day for Matt. I believe that day you communicated you wanted to come back.
I did. I mean, ever since I got out of the hospital, all I wanted to do was come back to the mission. It was the place that I've never been clean for 10 months since I started drugs. And I've been to many treatment centers, many states, and there's something about the mission that God's doing something good here. And it's, I can't explain it, but it's like a home to me. And at times when I'm home with my parents, I want to come back to the mission. For real.
I do understand that.
I came back helping up mission May 6th, 2006.
And the accident was?
March 4th. So about 2 months.
So just over 2 months later, it came back. Yeah.
I talked to Kevin and Rashid and you and Mike Rallo and Tom Bond, and you guys allowed me to come back a month early.
Yeah, and our rule is 3 months, but under the circumstances, made you start over.
Yeah, and I was fine with that.
You were, I remember. Of course, you were still recuperating, and you weren't feeling frisky, and you know.
Yeah, I was very out of it. I was on a lot of medications in that coma, a lot of drugs, which that's all I wanted to do.
And the feeling was it was conducive for your recovery to do that.
Yeah, and it made sense. It made the most sense.
Yeah, so we did, and you got healthier. I remember when the time came that you'd like to go to college, but we weren't letting you go day earlier than anybody else. So you had to wait your turn, and you were okay with that.
Yeah.
We had the talk, and you were okay with that. You got back to church then. Church became a part of your deal again.
Yeah, volunteering in the kitchen, volunteering in the disability ministry.
Was it hard coming back here and facing people?
Yeah. 3 weeks after I had come back, I watched my seed class that I came in with graduate, and it was like 8 of us. It was like a lot of guys.
Yeah, I remember.
But my mom came that day to graduation to sit with me and watch with me.
Yeah,
and it was cool to see that. And my friends up there, they I remember Will Sherrod saying, "You're here. You're still with us." You know.
So it wasn't hard really facing everybody coming back here.
No, I was happy to see them. They were happy to see me. Yeah. They're like, "You're alive." Like,
yeah. And how about church? How was it? How was it going back? Were you kind of scared?
Church was crazy. I got hit with a lot of attention because my dad's an elder there, so of course the church knew about everything.
Yeah.
And I had a lot of people there praying for me.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you
people.
Sure did. No doubt that was the reason things happened.
Power of prayer.
Yeah. So it's now been, what, 9 months, 8 months?
8 months.
8 months now. So what's different these 8 from the first 10 for you, as you see it?
When I got out of the coma, I had learned that two of my friends I was close with, they did the same thing. They put heroin in their bodies and they didn't wake up the next morning.
Yeah.
I did. So I knew that I had a purpose, that God, there's no reason why I should be alive from that. And I saw a purpose in my life, whether it be to share my story and maybe just help one other person not make the same mistake as I did, but really to put a value on life and to see how precious it is and fragile and realize you really have only one shot at this. We might get chances like that, we recover and we're in a coma, but that's rare. Most of the time that doesn't happen. Most of the people in the ICU unit die. So I have a purpose.
And you felt that when you once you came to and you realized that's what you felt and that's what you carried when you came back here.
Yeah.
What was your work therapy before you with your first time here?
My work therapy was the front desk.
All right, and of course that's where we put you back.
And they put me back. So I've been at the front desk for about 2 years, almost.
What's that mean to you, being at the front desk?
The front desk is one of my favorite things to do. And I really appreciate it now, because last time I just saw it as something I had to do. But if you actually take the time and sit still, you get to see people come in at their worst. And a couple weeks later, up to a month, you see a transformation in those same guys. And it's shocking. It's an amazing thing.
I also see a lot of nice people stop by and give us stuff.
I see a lot of people stop by and donate to this cause.
Yeah. You have a sensitivity that appreciates all.
Yeah, I get the chance to welcome them in, see if we can help them, and to be appreciative of just the littlest things that people donate to us every day.
Yeah.
And just to show gratitude that everything counts, that they have to offer to us.
Hey, one more thing, one more bit of information. The idea where you want to go with this is...
At first it was two things. It was either child abuse or substance abuse, but I think I'm pretty dead set on substance abuse field, just helping others like myself try to figure out this thing called life. You know, we're all on the same team.
Yeah.
We're all trying to just figure this thing out every day. And whatever I can do to help, that's what I'm going to do.
Anything else you want to say?
My family is family is a big thing.
Hmm.
Especially if you have family, a loving family.
Yeah.
Cherish it and enjoy it while you have it. You know, a lot of people go out on their weekends here. If I'm not working, I'm at home with my parents every weekend. And I'm okay with that. Because in high school, all I wanted to do was be away from them and go out and use. So it's like I'm making up the time I lost when I was in active addiction. And I love it. I love helping my family. And it's the best. It's my favorite time. Besides, you know, helping others in this program and working in an actual 12-step program.
And you are very active in your...
I am. I secretary my home group Thursday nights. I now sponsor someone. I can't tell who, but he's here. And I've had the pleasure of doing the steps. One thing I do need to say, for a lot of people who are turned off by the 12-step program, don't look at them like hurdles that you have to get through. Look at them like guardrails that you just have to stay in between. Like Mike Gray says, stay in your lane.
Nice.
And that's it. And you do them on a daily basis. You know, you don't just complete them and you're done. It's a daily thing.
So you know this is going to go in the newsletter and tens of thousands of people that support us. What do you want to say to them?
I've been thinking about this and, you know, I try to do two things today. For my recovery, to trust God and to help others. And I try to pass that on to the next. So to listeners out there, you don't have to be an addict to relate to my story. You just have to be a human being and realize that you guys are alive for a purpose. And in my experience, I'm only 25 years old, but I've seen a lot. And there is God in everything. And if you trust in it and you just take the time and be aware of it around you, you start to live life with a purpose. You start to see value in things. And what may seem little actually turns out to be bigger later on. And the second part is helping others. That's the key, because when I help someone else, it takes me out of Greg and Greg's mind. Whatever Greg's will is usually wrong. So when I'm helping another, I'm focused on them entirely. And that's what works for me today. It might not work for you, but try it.